Hello, and welcome again to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killett, your host. It's Friday, and it's time to have some fun, as we do on summer Fridays in particular. Second hour, our chaplain will be here, Father Hugh Barber. And that is always a good time. We're going to talk about, we'll talk a little bit about Mary and Martha. And what is up with Martha? We're going to straighten that out with our own chaplain the second hour. This hour, well, it is summer, and summer is movie season. I guess it's increasingly the case that all year is movie season. But man, do the blockbusters come out week after week in the summertime. We'll talk about all that and maybe some movies you haven't heard of this hour with our esteemed film critic and guest, Deacon Stephen Gradonis. He's the creator of DecentFilms.com and the film critic for the National Catholic Register. He's a member of the New York Film Critics Circle and a permanent deacon of the Catholic Archdiocese of Newark. With David DeSerto, he co-hosts the Gabriel Award-winning cable TV show Real Faith for the New Evangelization, for New Evangelization Television. Deacon Stephen Gradonis, thank you very much for being with us.
Sorry, it's great to be here.
It's like a blockbuster a week. Are you okay? Do you need to take a breath, or is it tough to get through the summer for a film critic?
You know, it really can be. Sometimes, some weeks, I have to decide, am I going to prepare my homily, or am I going to review the latest blockbuster? And it tends to keep my schedule up in the air.
Well, The blockbuster thing is really something, because they've got this down to a science, and the release of them and all that. I don't know how they do the magic they do, but I guess it was last weekend, The Lion King comes out, and this is a big property. They make a remake of it, and it's like $185 million in a weekend. So I would assume you've covered, I don't know what the budget for these things is, but I would assume you've covered your budget in the first weekend, and then you just start cashing checks for the rest of the summer.
And when you say they've got it down to a season, let's be clear. Disney has it down to a season. Right now they own the top three slots of the box office. The Lion King is on top, Spider-Man Far From Home, Toy Story 4, and you don't get to any other studios until after that. They've also got number six right now with their Aladdin remake.
And they just had one of their movies just became the highest grossing movie of all time, the Avengers, which is still playing in some theaters.
Yeah, they've been pushing that really, really hard. They really wanted to take down James Cameron's Avatar, which has stood atop that all-time record list for 10 years now. And if you don't adjust for inflation, Avengers Endgame has finally succeeded in doing that.
So I guess I remember at a certain point, Disney actually wasn't making great movies, and it didn't seem to be the strongest of the studios. It seems to me that might have turned around with The Little Mermaid, which is, what is that, 30 years ago or something? So is this all Michael Eisner's doing? Is that what happened at Disney?
It's a bunch of different things. Certainly the Disney Renaissance, which did start with The Little Mermaid back in 1989, was a big revitalization for Disney. The acquisition of Pixar was another major leap forward for them. And they've also had a gigantic monster profit machine with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and now they own Star Wars too. It's just the monster that swallowed Hollywood, and I have to say that I find their box office dominance kind of dispiriting, because most of the films that they produce are not that great. They don't generally produce terrible films, but they don't produce great films either. And the lack of competition and the lack of diversity in Hollywood's blockbuster offerings, the really big ticket films, the sameness of what's coming from the Mouse House, it kind of flattens out the landscape. When I started reviewing movies 20 years ago, I was reviewing a more diverse lineup of box office hits, and now it's mostly Disney most of the time, which does tend to push me more toward looking at the indie films, at the documentaries, at the foreign films, because there's still a lot of really interesting things going on there.
And there's this weird thing that Disney is doing. I don't know if it's weird. Maybe that's not the right word for it. It makes a lot of money, but they're just opening up the Disney Vault, and they're taking these films that were a hit
30, 40, 50 years ago, and they're remaking them with the new CGI technology or whatever. And they, I guess, is it nostalgia? I mean, the parents saw these movies, and so they take the kid to see the movie. It's an amazing business model. It's not a very creative one.
It's not, and unfortunately, they've gotten less creative as they went on. So the current box office champ, The Lion King, which is a very culturally significant film. There's a Broadway musical. It's got a lot of cultural significance, and we should really talk about it. But this film was redone now in ultra photorealistic computer animation by Jon Favreau, who did The Jungle Book back in 2016. And I thought that The Jungle Book was a great film. It reinvented the original cartoon by bringing in new themes and plot elements from the original Rudyard Kipling stories, including some religious themes, some moral themes that I thought made it more interesting than the original 1967 cartoon had been. But here, because they're dealing with a film from the Disney Renaissance, one of these sacred texts that the millennials grew up with and that they've raised their kids on, and like I say, there's a Broadway musical, you know, this is practically a shot-for-shot and line-for-line remake. As you say, it's not very creative, and it really underscores all of the things that the original cartoon, which I'm not even a big fan of, did well, that this new movie does much less well.
This is something I was very interested in reading your review in the National Catholic Register, and I really strongly suggest people, if you have the opportunity, make a habit of reading Deacon Gray Donis's reviews in the Register. The sense that you gave that realism actually damaged this remake, that you think, well, it's so much more beautiful than a hand-drawn movie and all that, you know, it's just this striking technology they have, but it didn't actually make it a better movie.
It didn't, and there are a number of reasons why that's the case. I mean, when we're dealing with anthropomorphic animals, you know, animals that represent human emotions and conflicts and stories, like C.S. Lewis did in The Chronicles of Narnia, or Beatrix Potter with her Peter Rabbit stories and the other stories of her world, a certain amount of stylization has to enter in, because these animals act more like people, and they interact and they convey emotions that real animals don't have. And one of the interesting things that Jon Favreau did when he made the original, when he redid The Jungle Book, was he decided that he was going to have the animals move and act as naturalistically as possible. And I think it really worked there, in part because he has a human protagonist, Mowgli. He has this, even though most of the jungle and most of the surroundings and all of the animals are CGI, there's a human being at the center, and that brings some real emotion to it, and it brings some cinematic reality. Here in The Jungle Book, you know, you've got what's basically a retelling of themes from Hamlet and the Bible and other Shakespearean plays. So there's a lot of emotion, and the characters just aren't able to convey it the way that a hand-drawn cartoon could. I was really struck, by the way, in the original Lion King, when the bird Zazu comes and he bows down before Mufasa, the great Lion King, played by James Earl Jones, in both of these versions. And Mufasa looks down at him, and he gives him this kind of gracious smile and a nod of acknowledgement. And the lion, the photorealistic version in this film, he can't do any of that. He just has what I called in my review, resting lion face. There's a reaction shot with no reaction, and it really underscored the limitations of this approach for me.
So if you make a perfect animal represented on film, it turns out it looks like an animal and not a person. So
and that can work too, but you need a different approach. You need to rewrite the story and rethink the material, and unfortunately that's just what Favreau wasn't allowed to do. I don't know if you've ever seen Favreau's movie Chef.
Oh, okay. First of all, I have seen Favreau's movie Chef. I'm a real fan of his. I think he's a very fine filmmaker.
So as I was watching the trailers for The Lion King months ago, it suddenly occurred to me, here's a guy, here's a talent who has been creative and done interesting work in the past, but now his boss is kind of reining him in and making him do the exact thing that his boss wants him to do. And I thought, oh my goodness, it's just like Chef, and Dustin Hoffman is Disney.
I saw your meme essay on this and it cracked me up. It is because it's so perfect. It's like Favreau has actually made the movie before of the creative guy who's hamstrung by the boss that just wants a repeat, and then he went out and did it in real life.
Yes, yes. So I did this meme essay, the Lion King Chef, in which I played off on the lines from Favreau's movie Chef and applied them to the situation. In all of my 20 years of film criticism, this is one of the things that I most love.
Yeah, if you can see it at decentfilms.com, right? Or should you just Google Lion King Chef? Probably both will get you there. But head over to decentfilms.com. You won't be sorry you did, but this is a very funny essay about John. If you're a John Favreau fan, it's very clever. You'll enjoy it. We have to take a quick break. We're talking summer movies with one of the finest movie reviewers you can get. It turns out he's also a member of the Catholic clergy. He's a deacon, Deacon Stephen Gradonis. More with him on movies right after this.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
New on EWTN Radio, The Church Alive.
This is St. Monica, who I think is one of those great role models for so many mothers today.
My mother passed on to eternal life 8 years ago on the Feast of St. Monica. And you know, what a powerful example for me, because I know she prayed me back to the church.
The Church Alive with Brian Patrick, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and Father Thomas Petrie. Saturday at 7 a.m. and 1 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
This hour, Deacon Stephen Gradonis, our guest. You can read his reviews at the National Catholic Register. You can find him at decentfilms.com, and you can see him on his program Real Faith on the New Evangelization Television Network. We're talking a little bit about The Lion King and about Disney's dominance at the movie theater right now. But this one director, Jon Favreau, who directed the remake of...
The Jungle Book.
The Jungle Book, which was very broadly praised, kind of wildly praised in many places, and a tremendous work. And then he also did the remake of the new Lion King, which is not receiving the same praise. In part, now, your suggestion in your review is this... the missing human element. He didn't bring out the human element that Mowgli provided in the other film. But as far as the themes of these two movies, you mentioned a couple times religious themes. You mentioned the Bible in reference to The Lion King. You referenced the kind of religious undertones in the Jungle Book that Favreau made. Can you kind of elaborate on that? What are the themes that we see, the religious themes being developed, and what is a Catholic person to make of these?
Sure. So for various reasons, I'm not a huge fan of The Lion King, but it does have a lot of Catholic fans. My co-host at Real Faith, David DeSerto, is a big fan of the original 1994 cartoon, and I do understand some of the reasons why. So this was Disney's ostensibly first truly original animated film that was not explicitly based on some previous material. And in developing the story, they really went back to a lot of the foundational texts of Western society. They went to the Bible and they drew a little on the story of Joseph from the Old Testament and Moses. They drew on aspects of some of Shakespeare's stories, particularly Hamlet. And And they drew on foundational ideas from Christian fairy tales and Christian imagination. I was really struck watching the trailer for the original Lion King back in 1994, which consisted simply of the opening Circle of Life number, at the way that Mufasa is portrayed. And to see a king, someone with royal authority, portrayed in such an unambiguously positive light, and all of the animals come and they bow down before him, and they celebrate the birth of the prince of of Simba. To see that in a pop culture work of that era is something really striking. There is a celebration of tradition. Of a kind of social order that involves hierarchy. All of this is very compatible with Catholic imagination going back to the Middle Ages. And even a whisper of religious ritual. There's a baptism-like ritual that a shaman-like baboon, he kind of anoints Simba with some kind of he gives him some kind of anointing. And then there's also a kind of suggestion of the afterlife, of the idea that our ancestors who've gone on look down on us from the heavens and that they can even guide us. And of course, while you know this connects to a lot of things, including ancestor worship in non-Christian religions, it also connects to the Catholic veneration of the saints. And so for all of these reasons, I think it's a film that has intrigued Catholics and other Christians.
And the Jungle Book.
Yeah. So Favreau's Jungle Book really does some interesting things in bringing in elements from Rudyard Kipling that were not present in the original Disney 1967 cartoon. So. Now, Kipling was not a believer. He was not a Christian, but he was certainly formed in a cultural world that was much more Christian than our world today. And in fact, he once described himself as a God-fearing Christian atheist. And so I think that as a 19th century Indian-born English colonialist, he had an understanding and appreciation of both Christianity and paganism that he brought in a way similar to C.S. Lewis in The Chronicles of Narnia to the mythology of the Jungle Book. So he gives the animals a creation myth in which the elephants create the jungle, and they dredge it up from the primordial waters of chaos with their tusks. And we get a hint of this in Favreau's Jungle Book when Bagheera tells Mowgli, as the elephants march by, they're treated with real reverence. It's not at all like the kind of jokey treatment in the original cartoon. They're treated with reverence and awe. And Bagheera says to him, "The elephants created this jungle. They made all that belongs: the mountains, the trees, the birds. But they did not make you." And there's this sense that in this kind of animal creation myth, man is an outlier. Mankind does not belong with the animals. He stands apart. And that's a theme that runs all through the film, the idea that Mowgli is different, not just that he belongs with his own kind, but that he has these man tricks. He has this creativity and this aptitude for tools and problem solving that makes him a natural leader in among the animals, as we see later in the film.
That is fascinating, because you have a sense in the kind of postmodernism of collapsing humans back into the animal kingdom, in a sense that you're nothing special. You're just a well adapted creature. There's no mystery here.
Yeah, and I think that there is. I think that that's one of the things that I most like about Favreau's Jungle Book, is that there is a specifically human mystery. There is a kind of human exceptionalism. The end of the movie, he doesn't, this is a bit of a spoiler, but he doesn't end up going back to the man village the way that he does in the cartoon. But at the same time, his story isn't over, and Favreau is in fact doing a Jungle Book 2, I understand. So we may see Mowgli rejoin his own kind yet.
Now, as far as protagonists go, Mowgli, in your view, is a better protagonist than Little Simba?
My biggest problem with The Lion King, both the original and the new film, is Simba is just a really boring protagonist. I mean, people have compared this story to Hamlet for obvious reasons. Thematically, it's got a lot in common with Hamlet, except that what makes Hamlet interesting is Hamlet is so complex and psychologically a mystery, and he struggles and he debates and he doesn't know what to do. Simba always uncritically accepts someone else's version of who he's supposed to be and what he's supposed to be doing. He never wrestles or struggles with what he's supposed to do in the sense of trying to figure out anything for himself. First, his father tells him, you're going to follow in my footsteps, and he just can't wait to be king. And then Scar comes along and tells him, you caused your father's death, and he runs away and accepts that. And then Timon and Pumbaa tell him that Hakuna Matata, and he has no worries for the rest of his days. And then Nala comes back, and his father appears to him from the sky, and he says, okay, I have to go back. All of this happens with virtually no inner conflict or with no effort to resolve anything for himself. He has no particular admirable qualities. He has no qualities at all. He doesn't, you know, he just kind of goes through the story and he fulfills this archetypal role, but nobody ever really thought about, you know, who is Simba and why should he be the one to lead? What traits does he have? What does he learn from his experiences?
Yeah, Nala's a way better character.
Yeah. and it's one of the things that you can accept a little more easily in the cartoon than you can in the more realistic version. You know, the idea of the male lion being the leader of the pride. In nature, the females have a much more dominant social role. The male has the role of protecting the pride.
Right.
But the females are much more active. And when you see these photorealistic lions behaving, like the ones in the cartoon, it's a little weird.
While we're talking about these two Disney films, and they're these big blockbusters, and as you said, there's a certain way in which this massive success that Disney is enjoying right now, it really is Disney's moment in the universe, is kind of dulling down films in a way. There's a kind of sameness to the look of them, to the high points, to the low points, to the way that these films work. And it is successful, so I'm sure it'll keep going as long as it's making a lot of money. But this director, Jon Favreau, has made other fine films. He actually is the guy who revolutionized superhero movies by making one of the maybe the greatest superhero movie ever made, the first Iron Man, that just changed everything as far as the way they looked and felt. But he made a film we talked about a couple times, Chef. And Chef is not an unproblematic film, but it's a very well-made, good film. I just want to get your take on a film like Chef and where films like that fit now.
So the first thing I want to say about Chef is that it's one of the best father-son stories that I have ever seen. And what makes it so great is that it captures the struggles of many modern fathers that you see in so many films that they're preoccupied with their work. In this case, Carl, who's played by Favreau himself, is a chef at a swanky restaurant, and he's struggling with his creativity and with his boss's expectations. And he's divorced from his son's mother, and you know, his son just wants to spend time with him. He doesn't want to, you know, go to the amusement park or go to the movies, as we see in a montage that literally lasts 2 seconds, 1 second in the movie theater, 1 second on a roller coaster. He doesn't want that. He just wants to, like, hang out and do things with his dad. And we don't get the big redemption where the father decides that, you know, to throw everything overboard and to suddenly be a hero. Instead, they go on this road trip of self-reinvention when Carl finds himself no longer employed at the restaurant. And I'm not going to spoil the direction that the movie goes in, but it becomes this really wonderful celebration of relationships, of, you know, the ways that the different generations interact. His son is more tech savvy. He understands social media. The father understands cooking and food, and they each have something to share with the other. It becomes a celebration of local culture, of music, of cuisine, and Where another movie would have a kind of cheap, unnecessary conflict in the last act to juice things up, Chef just throws that overboard and says, no, we're just going to have fun. And it's just, it really is so wonderful in that way.
Yeah, and I've never, I've never encountered a movie that made me want to eat a Cuban sandwich so much. I didn't even know what a Cuban sandwich was. And man, there is... I mean, I don't know if that movie made any money or if it's the kind of thing where Favreau has to make super blockbusters in order to have the opportunity to make these smaller movies. But people are still making these films, like very fine. There's still fine work being done in the movies.
Oh, there's lots of, you know, every year I put together a list of my top 30 films, not my top 10 or even top 20, but top 30 films. And, you know, around mid-year, I'm always wondering, is it really going to happen? But by the time I get to the end of the year, it's like, what am I going to cut out?
Our guest is Deacon Stephen Greydonis. He is a film critic from the New York Film Critics Circle. And we will continue with our conversation about summer movies right after this.
This is Bishop James Conley of the Diocese of Lincoln. Keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Turns out that today, as back then, this question has a lot of different answers. So many groups want to appropriate Jesus, tweaking his identity until he looks and sounds just like one of them. But then you no longer have the Lord, says apologist Trent Horn. You have an imposter. In his new groundbreaking book, Counterfeit Christ, Trent exposes 18 phony versions of Jesus that we encounter today, helping you to recognize the fakes when you see them, explain why they're phony, and make a case for the full truth and beauty of who Jesus is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Order your copy of Counterfeit Christ today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
I'm Gloria Purvis.
I'm Monsignor Charles Pope.
And I'm Deacon Harold. The Morning Glory team talks about priestly celibacy, living as Christ.
Monday morning, 7 Eastern. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Second hour, our chaplain will be here, Father Hugh Barber, Norbertine priest extraordinaire. I don't know if you're allowed to put that at the end of a priest. I don't know if you're allowed to put a title like that or a appendage to what you call a priest. But he is a wonderful priest, and he is our chaplain, and we'll be sharing him with you next hour as we talk about, well, the Feast of St. Martha, which is next Monday, and gives us an opportunity to reflect with him on the spiritual life, the active life, the contemplative life, and what it is that Jesus is offering us in offering us what we could call the fullness of life. We'll do that next hour. This hour, we visit with Deacon Stephen Greydonis, a Catholic deacon, which makes him a Catholic clergyman now for 3 years. Is that right, Deacon?
Yes. We were my class was the class of 2016, so we've just celebrated our third anniversary.
You've been longer than that. You've been a film critic.
Yes, since 2000, when I first came on this show back in 2000 and kind of got my start.
Well, that must have been with Patrick Coffin, and he's a real aficionado of film. He loves film. At least that's
this
my...
This was before Patrick.
Oh, even before Patrick. Oh.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember who the host was at that time. There was Johnny.
And then there was probably somebody... Jerry
Usher. One of them.
Yeah. Yeah, so I muddle through. I'm not as up on every. I think particularly I remember hearing Patrick talk about Japanese film. He really knew Japanese film, and I pretend like I do. You know, I don't want to cede any ground to Patrick. Deacon Steve Agredanis, as I said, is a film critic for the National Catholic Register. He's a member of the New York Film Critics Circle. That sounds so prestigious. Every time I say it, I feel like that's quite a thing to have. David DeSerto is his co-host on the Gabriel Award-winning cable TV show Real Faith for New Evangelization Television. I remember 1969. It's probably the first year that I remember. I remember living across the street from my grandmother and then every few hours going over to her house to watch television with her because they would break in when there was more news on the Apollo mission. And it was, we'll be back in 2 hours. And then I'd be like, okay, coming back to grandma's house in 2 hours, sitting on the floor, watching the astronauts. And there'd be certain things that would happen. Okay, next thing they'll leave orbit. And next thing they'll reach the halfway point. And then they'd come back on TV and talk about it. And it was very, very exciting time. I actually thought as a five-year-old, we'd probably all be living on the moon at some point. That didn't happen. For a variety of reasons, but here on the 50th anniversary of the Apollo missions, certainly that was an event that affected film and has been the subject of films a great deal. So what do you make of Apollo 11, 50 years, Deacon Agredanis, and its impact on film?
First of all, from a Catholic perspective, as I watched some of the documentaries celebrating these dramatic landmarks in space travel, including the Apollo 11 project and landing on the moon, I think of Pope Paul VI, who was a huge space travel fan and who loved to watch those films. He was friends with the Italian film director Franco Zeffirelli, who we talked about in our last show together. And Zeffirelli just happens to have a contact at NASA who would lend him film from the various space flights and projects that led to the landing on the moon. He would lend them to Zeffirelli so that Zeffirelli could have dinner with Paul VI and they could watch these films together.
Great?
And
wait a second, if I may interrupt you, I thought the Catholic Church was anti-science. Did I miss something here?
Paul VI would definitely have a quarrel with that theory, and I'm sure our listeners know, so would a lot of other popes and scientists down through the ages. That is, of course, a very common canard against the faith. But Paul VI, as I say, was just really fascinated by space travel, and after watching on television as men landed on the moon and looking at the moon through the Castel Gandolfo telescope, he sent a message to the astronauts on the moon. Honor, greetings, and blessings to you, conquerors of the moon, he said, calling the moon the pale lamp of our nights and our dreams. And he talked about the astronauts bringing with their presence the voice of the Spirit, the hymn to God, our Creator and our Father. He went on to praise the men of science at NASA who helped to engineer this, presumably also the women. And we think as we watch hidden figures of those women of color, the computers working in the segregated facilities at Langley, Virginia, who helped to make the calculations that put John Glenn into space and that helped to pave the way for this conquering of the moon. But these video materials have been put together into a number of really excellent documentaries that are highly rewarding to watch today, particularly since, as you say, we haven't gone back to the moon. And so it's become a kind of almost mythical thing. You know, kids today grow up and they've always known a world where men landed on the moon, but they've never, you know, men aren't on the moon now. So I think these documentaries, like the one that just came out this year, Apollo 11, which includes a lot of footage, really high quality, high resolution, 65 millimeter negatives blown up to 70 millimeter film, images that have never before been seen. And if you happen to live in a place around the country where it's still in theaters, especially if you can see it in IMAX, it's really, really awesome. And it just puts you back to that day in 1969.
Well, because I want to talk to you about some of the films that kind of come from the space age a little bit that you mm-hmm. might recommend or maybe might steer us away from. But I want to tell you about an experience that I had recently. I watched I think it's a 1961 movie called Phantom Planet that involves people on the moon. And I was thinking that was only 5 years before 2001, A Space Odyssey. And the quality of the special effects, the way that space was depicted, utterly changed with 2001, A Space Odyssey. And I wonder if there's the fact that we were really going to the moon, that it was really a real thing, might have influenced movie makers to get more realistic about space travel.
I think that's probably true, but it's also true that Kubrick was meticulous in his pursuit of realism and in figuring out how things would be done even if we hadn't done them yet. And I think he probably would have made 2001 A Space Odyssey pretty much the same if he'd done it 10 years earlier. It's really interesting to go back to some of the very early films, to A Trip to the Moon by Georges Méliès, for instance, 1902, very early silent film, which, although it has some comic and some ridiculous conceits, also is somewhat inspired by H.G. Wells, who already in the 19th century figured out very important things about our trip to the moon, such as the fact that an American mission to the moon would probably launch from Florida, and in fact near Cape Canaveral. Cape Canaveral didn't exist as a location, but H.G. Wells put the launch point close to it because he understood the physics and he understood why that would make sense.
How interesting. So tell me about some of the Apollo 11 or Apollo 11 inspired films that we might consider.
So first of all, definitely Apollo 11, the documentary that's in theaters right now. What's special about this is not just its that previously unseen footage that the director, Todd Douglas Miller, was able to incorporate in it, but his approach to the material is pure documentary. It's direct filmmaking in the sense that he just takes these film elements and he assembles them, he edits them. There's a wonderful sound design, but there's no intrusion. There's no talking head interviews. There's no voiceover. There's no modern presence. You are in 1969, and you're just watching it as the story unfolds. It's mesmerizing. It's breathtaking. The images are fantastic, and that's what makes Apollo 11 a special film. Now, if you want a more conventional documentary with the talking heads, probably the best one is David Sinkton's In the Shadow of the Moon from 2007. This also includes some spectacular archival imagery from NASA, but you've got 10 of the Apollo astronauts, including Aldrin Collins, Jim Lovell, offering their memories, their reminiscences, their reflections, their insights. They cover really a broad swath of the whole Apollo project, including some of the failures, the terrible 1967 fire on the launch pad of Apollo 1 that killed three astronauts, the obviously Apollo 13, the mission that could have killed three more. But they also talk about their spiritual experiences of, you know, the sense of what happens when you step out from the planet and how that makes you reflect on what it means to be human. One of the astronauts, we hear about the Genesis 1 reading from orbiting the moon. One of them talks about, you know, his walk on the moon lasting 3 days, but his walk with God lasting forever.
Isn't that beautiful? Because you get that's the way it's supposed to work, I guess, is that science and engineering allow us to explore God's creation, which actually inspires us and makes us more human and more fully alive spiritually. It's not a competition, these two things.
Absolutely not. That was something that that Einstein understood well. Einstein was not necessarily a believer in God, but he certainly had that recognition of the idea of the awe before the mystery of the universe, and he would have resonated with the idea of science as thinking God's thoughts after him, even if the idea of the mystery of God was something he would not have necessarily put his faith in.
Last year's movie, First Man. Good, bad, indifferent?
I liked First Man. First Man is first of all, it's from Damien Chazelle, and it stars Ryan Gosling as Neil Armstrong, and it's much more kind of a portrait of who Neil Armstrong was as a person than a film about the Apollo project necessarily, or about the moon landing. It's more about the man than the first, you might say. And so it looks at what kind of person drives himself to break these boundaries and to achieve things that have never been achieved before. And for Armstrong, it really was about that sense of revelation, that sense of how going to the moon changes not necessarily our understanding of the moon, but our understanding of who we are. It transforms us, and that's why it was important to him to do it. It was based on the official biography of Armstrong by James R. Hansen, and it has some interesting insights into the relationship between Armstrong's great achievements and the tragic loss of his two-year-old daughter to an inoperable brain tumor. And for what it's worth, Armstrong's sons had input on the film, and their verdict on it was that it basically got their father right.
How weird must it be to be Neil Armstrong's son? I mean, talk about what am I going to do? How am I going to top that? Somebody should make a movie about that. We need a father and son movie from Jon Favreau about that, when your father is the first man who stepped on another planet.
Yeah, but then, of course, you also have to weigh that against the fact that, like many of the Apollo astronauts, Neil Armstrong's marriage ended in divorce. And so there's a certain extent to which, and we see this in the film, that he was, you know, as a father, he was somewhat distant from his sons. And that's part of that story also. And sometimes the people who achieve these great things out in the world, you know, that there's that disconnect between their home life and what they do in public. And that is part of what either it drives them, or it's a side effect or a consequence, whatever it is, there's an ambiguity there. There's tragedy as well as celebration.
Deacon Stephen Greidanis is our guest. We're talking summer films with Deacon Greidanis. And I got a couple that I want to ask you about. Well, in particular, I want to ask you about this movie Yesterday, about a guy who, I don't even know how to describe it, but it's got a lot of Beatles songs. It's a Beatles movie, and
it is a Beatles themed movie.
But I gotta take the break first, and I'm gonna come back and ask you about it when we come back. All right.
All right.
All right. Be right back with more summer films with Deacon Stephen Greidanis right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
A very wonderful woman I knew had four children, and all four died. And somebody went up to her one day, and they said, "Oh, what a pity." And she said, "Oh, no, what a blessing. If we don't begin to look at everything with the eyes of Jesus, you will become helpless and hopeless."
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having a fun summer Friday here with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Deacon Gradonis is the film critic for the National Catholic Register, a member of the New York Film Critics Circle, and with David DeCerto, one of the hosts of the Gabriel Award-winning cable TV show Real Faith on the New Evangelization Television. Also a deacon of the Catholic Church, and so in a particularly fortuitous position to be able to tell us about many of the films coming out. You sometimes bring us a smaller film, maybe a foreign film, maybe a documentary that you want to recommend to us. Have you got one?
I do. I really want to say, if you get a chance to see The Farewell, this is a gorgeous and winning comedy drama in Chinese mostly, although there's some English also. It's about an extended Chinese family who go to unusual lengths to gather around a dying matriarch who doesn't know that she's dying. It's based on a true story. The writer-director Lulu Wang has told her story on This American Life. Apparently, it's not uncommon for Chinese families not to talk about death with their aging family members until the end is near. But in this case, the family goes to the elaborate extreme of staging a fake wedding as an excuse to get all the family members together so that they can all say goodbye to grandma or to Nai Nai, as she's called in the film. So the Awkwafina, the actress you might remember her from. From Crazy Rich Asians.
Right.
She plays the protagonist whose cousin and his Japanese girlfriend are supposedly getting married as the family converges on her hometown where she grew up in China, but now she lives in New York. So you've got this cross-cultural thing happening, a sense of dual identity, the struggle between the American sensibility that you should tell people the truth. It's her life and she deserves to know what's happening to her. And the different Chinese sensibility. It raises all kinds of interesting moral questions about truth and about family dynamics, and doesn't necessarily resolve any of them, but the way that it engages and explores them, as it tells a story that's really, you know, quite funny at times, but also definitely, you know, it made me cry, which is no great feat, I admit.
Oh, really? You're one of those, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yes. You know, I can cry at almost anything, but The Farewell. Definitely worth catching.
Very good. The Farewell with Awkwafina. You might have to search for it. She was in Ocean's 8, I think.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
she's
right.
Wonderful.
Yeah, she played the pickpocket.
Right. Sometime we have to talk about about Chinese film and the Chinese film industry. And I'd love to talk with you about that for a little while on a show, because that's changing the whole world of film. I guess having a billion people who can afford to go see your movie will influence the way people make movies.
Yes, absolutely. And that also raises the somewhat sinister topic of how is China's box office dominance affecting American cinema? And how are American studios, including Disney, willing to tailor their material to China's satisfaction?
Right. Because while the Chinese people are there, it's just wonderful what's happening with the Chinese people becoming wealthy enough to participate in the world economy and all that. The Chinese Communist Party is just as rotten as it ever was. And that is not an influence you want, certainly on art or anything else. They'll throw it off one of these days. We can pray to God. But so if I may move to a movie that I have not seen. But every time we see the commercial for it, my wife and I say, we got to go see that Yesterday.
So if you are a fan of the music of the Beatles, Yesterday is certainly catnip to a certain extent.
Yep.
It is a celebration of great music. It tells a fantastical story about a musician, a struggling musician, who has an accident amid a global event that has the mysterious effect of wiping out all traces of the existence of the Beatles. So no one remembers them. Their albums don't exist anymore, but he remembers them. He remembers their music. At least, you know, he kind of does. He's trying to write things down and capture it all before it fades from his memory. And so this is a kind of an interesting premise. For me, it has a sort of Groundhog Day-ish vibe, because you have a character who is the only one who knows how the world had about this weird thing that's happened to the world, and it gives him a power that other people don't have, because he's able now to produce this amazing music that mesmerizes people, and they're like, you know, wow, where did these songs come from? I was not a huge fan of the movie for several reasons. I didn't think that it really took its protagonist on a persuasive journey, particularly the journey that he needed to go on, a journey of redemption after the dishonesty of what he does. He's got a love interest who I think the movie could have done a better job of developing their relationship and what it is that she sees in him. At the end, I didn't think that the movie really cross-examined him or the premise in the way that, say, Groundhog Day did. Because if you think about it, you know, if the Beatles had never existed and we were hearing their songs for the first time, we wouldn't react the way that people did back in the 1960s. It would have a completely different sound to us because of the way that it's influenced and shaped so many other things. We haven't heard the Beatles, maybe, but we've heard the Rolling Stones, we've heard Bob Dylan, and while I still think the songs are obviously great and anybody would recognize that, I also think that the idea that he becomes a global phenomenon would not really happen.
All right. Now, we categorize them by go to the movie theater to see them, rent them when they come out, or wait for them to come on television.
And that's a very common and very sensible thing to do.
And I think it might have got moved down to a rental or a wait now. Oh, well.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
And I believed in yesterday, but now... Oh, sorry. That was terrible. That was unworthy of... I hope that Nick can cut that out. Deacon, we mentioned before that you've been 3 years a deacon. I'd like to ask you a little bit about your vocation, about what it has meant to you, and about where you are 3 years on as a member of the Catholic clergy.
So one of the things that I'm finding now is that the scriptures that I was preaching on when I first began homiletics are now coming around again in the liturgical cycle of 3 years. So I just preached on the parable of the Good Samaritan for the second time, and that was something. You know, the way in which you're formed by your participation in the liturgy as a deacon is, I have found, to be quite different. One of the things I thought I would miss terribly was not being in the choir during the Holy Triduum, especially on Holy Thursday and Good Friday. The music that we do at my church, the Russian chant and other stuff, is so beautiful. And yet, I found, as a deacon, that I needed to be on the altar. I needed to be doing the things that I was doing as a deacon, even when I was just sitting in the dark in the Easter Vigil. It's really transformed my whole experience of the liturgy and the way that I interact with other people. It's been a huge blessing to me, and I hope and believe it's been a blessing to the people in my life.
And so, when you preach again on these things, where did you do you happen to remember what you first preached on? What the Sunday reading was?
It's funny. I've blogged every one of my homilies at the National Catholic Register except for my first one. I have it. I haven't gone back to look at it since I preached it. So I don't actually remember, but I remember that I preached on the idea of resurrection and faith. But I don't remember what the texts were.
So Monday is Martha, the feast of Saint Martha, and that's what we're going to talk about with our chaplain.
Oh yes,
next hour. So have you preached on that one?
I have not, but I have a thought about it, which I'll be happy to share with you. Whenever I hear a homily about Mary and Martha, I always am a little bit on the edge of my seat because I wonder, is the homilist going to mess it up? This is one of those texts like the feeding of the 5,000 where you're like, okay, are we going to get the generosity homily today? And with Mary and Martha, what homilists are always tempted to say is that we need both Mary and Martha, which is true. We need action and contemplation. Those are both good things. But what our Lord says in the gospel is that one thing is necessary, and that's what Mary has chosen to sit at Jesus' feet. When I point this out to people, they sometimes say to me, but what about dinner? You know, is everybody just going to starve while you're sitting at Jesus' feet and listening? And I always say, you know what? If Martha had been sitting at Jesus' feet next to Mary, at some point our Lord would have said, so, how about dinner? And it would have been completely different because then they would have been serving, Martha would have been serving perhaps, or Mary with her, in obedience to the Lord, out of listening to him, and all of that anxiety and worry would have been completely gone.
We do not live in an age that loves contemplation, however, or even knows what it is, I think, to sit quietly and listen to the Lord, because we're busy and everything, it's a loud era.
It absolutely is. And you know, this is something that I have preached on many times, the fact that we carry our distractions with us in our pockets from the moment we wake up in the morning to the moment we go to bed. That does make it very difficult to hear the voice of the Lord.
If you want to know more about Deacon Stephen Gradonis, you can visit decentfilms.com. You can go over to the National Catholic Register and find his posts and his film critiques there. And you can find him on the Gabriel Award-winning cable TV show Real Faith for the New Evangelization Television Network. Deacon Gradonis, thank you very much. It's always a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Si. It's great to be here.
And we'll look for the farewell, your recommendation this week. Up next, we are going to talk about Mary and Martha with our chaplain, Father Hugh Barber. See you for that right after this.